September 2015, Frederick Nygaard wrote to me regarding the interviews and research I had done with Peter Woodhead in relation to the mechanism behind the expansion of planet Earth. Frederick sent me a number of articles regarding his thoughts and calculations on how the Earth's gravity has changed because of what might be loosely termed electrical effects. His research relates to the so-called electric universe model, and Frederick suggests that gravity works not as a monopole, but as a dipole. Frederick recently completed a very interesting essay entitled The Gravity Mystery, which brings his earlier research and conclusions together in a lucid and very interesting manner. This article is posted on checktheevidence.com. Frederick studied electrical engineering, but has worked as a programmer professionally. He said to me in an email, "My fascination with programming is that anything goes as long as it's logical. There is no good or bad rule. As long as they are coherent and consistent, they are all equally good. And this may be why I do not take established physics very seriously. Seeing that their rules do not fit the observed facts, I decided I might as well come up with an alternative rule set that does." I spoke to Frederick on Sunday, 9th of October 2016, and recorded the following interview. I'm here today with Frederick Nygaard, and I hope I've pronounced your name properly, Frederick.
Yeah, that's a good proper pronunciation, yes.
Great. And we're going to talk about some of the articles that you've done that I've posted on Check the Evidence, and we're going to get into that in the next few minutes. But I'm just wondering, you know, if you could tell us a little bit more about your background initially, and what sort of, because I understand you've got a technical background, so if you could tell us a bit more about that.
Yeah, I studied as an electrical engineer in Surrey, in England, actually. So I have a degree from Surrey in electrical engineering. But I spent my entire professional career as a programmer. So I have not really worked directly with electronics, but I know quite the basics from my university studies. Yeah.
Fantastic. So what made you change into sort of software and programming? Was a particular, was that just the job that came up and, or, you know, something?
It was what my passion at the time was, really, programming. I had been playing around on Apple, these Apple computers, the very first ones that came out. And I've been making software, and I enjoyed that a lot. But at the time when I went to university, there weren't any courses in programming. So the closest you could get was actually electronics. And so I took a course in electronics with the idea that I would focus on programming mainly.
Well, I think that's very interesting because, you know, that was my background, programming. And I did a little bit of electronics for a hobby. I didn't feel I understood it as well as doing software. So I'm just saying that because, you know, we have that sort of commonality of our backgrounds. And I think going into what we're going to talk about in a few minutes, your knowledge of electronics and electricity has actually become very important to what I think is, you know, some of the important revelations that you've sort of come across and made in some of your articles. And going into that area a little bit, you know, the reason that we originally came into contact, which I think was just over a year ago, was that you'd watched this interview with Peter Woodhead that I'd recorded, it must be a couple of years ago now, about the expanding Earth. And, you know, just before we started recording this, we had a quick chat. And that was the first thing that you found. So can you tell us a bit more about how you came across that, and, you know, why it came onto your radar screen and whatnot?
Yes, it started with a friend of mine mentioning the expanding Earth. This was completely unrelated to anything else. It just mentioned it, and I thought that's a crazy idea. But this was a guy who said, well, as far as I can understand, it's just as good as any other theory. Mm-hmm. So I looked around and I found this Neil Adams excellent video on YouTube. Mm. And looking at it and finding also other stuff on YouTube on the expanding Earth, I got convinced that this really made a lot of sense. So my immediate question then was, but how? You know, how can the planet just expand like that? And so I started looking for answers to that question. And there were all sorts, so there still are, all sorts of, you know, explanations that are tossed about. And they all involve some sort of magical process in which matter is accumulated or created even inside the planet. And that didn't convince me much. So, I was, just continued looking until I found Peter Woodhead's theory, the interview that you did, an excellent interview, and immediately I thought, oh, that's it, obviously. It's very simple, it doesn't involve any magic, it's just simply a gas expansion that's happening inside our planet. It doesn't require any magic beyond that, and so that's where... that really triggered me, and then what happened then after that was that after a while I'd been thinking about this, and then, well, this doesn't really fit the standard model of gravity, so I contacted Peter Woodhead with an email asking him about a few things that was sort of bothering me about it. Then we pretty soon developed a sort of a friendship, and sort of we're looking into this together, because obviously it did not fit the standard model, and that's where I started, and I wrote several articles and more essays and on the subject to try to figure this out.
Well, we'll talk about that in a few minutes. Well, that's great, and I'm glad that you were able to sort of find the interview that we did, because, you know, you certainly from where I'm sitting, you know, you put these things out there and you don't quite know where they're going to end up or who's going to see them. So, you know, I for one was very grateful when you also contacted me and we sort of exchanged our ideas and whatnot, which we'll talk about in a few minutes. And I think, you know, you really have done an excellent job. We're going to talk primarily about this, I think, because the problem that we were looking at, both Peter and myself, was what happens with gravity, because the big argument came, didn't it, when we started saying, well, if you've got this Earth, which is essentially not solid in the middle, it's filled with gas, then... you know, that means that something's going to happen with gravity, or we're going to have to recalculate the mass of the Earth or something like that. And, you know, and those arguments became quite complicated. And I think for many people, at least, what Peter had proposed, they would dismiss it out of hand because ultimately of the gravity and mass issues, which, again, we'll talk about a little bit more about. But I think what we said just before, you know, before we did this interview, was that we wanted to start with your conclusion, which I think you'd got it down to two or three lines, haven't you? So let's do that. Let's do what you suggested, because I like that idea. And let's start with the conclusion. We've talked about the expanding over that. You went on to various, you know, things that we're going to talk about. But what was your final kind of conclusion up to now, at least, that from going through that process?
Yeah, this is obviously a sort of work in progress, but at this moment I feel very confident that there's a certain thing we can say pretty much for sure about gravity, and that's that the standard model is wrong. And the standard model essentially says that matter attracts matter. It's a very simple equation developed by Newton in his time. And it's elegant, and it's very predictable. He makes good predictions about things, but it doesn't actually work when you start to consider the observations, other observations, right? So the conclusion I came to was that it isn't matter attracting matter, but it's charge inside matter attracting matter. So if you can imagine all planets, all moons, all stars, they're charged bodies. And it's the charge inside of these bodies that attract matter. So, and that's a very important distinction. It's not that different, really, from saying matter attracts matter. It's similar, but it makes a big difference when you try to explain dinosaurs and you try to explain expanding Earth, you try to explain these things, then suddenly the charge theory actually makes more sense.
And that's, I think, if we can just mention that, because that's, of course, one of the key things that Peter and I were trying to understand when we started looking at the Earth expansion evidence. That was one of the things, wasn't it? This idea that the force of gravity has changed on the surface of the Earth, and this essay, which we'll talk about a little bit later, the latest one, you actually start, that's the starting point, isn't it? The dragonfly, the ancient dragonfly. So just mention about that, because that ties in then to this idea of gravity changing for some reason.
Yeah, that's when I started looking at the whole problem. I started by, as I said, with the expanding Earth. And then it was, I was drawn to this work by Stephen Hurrell, mm-hmm. who wrote an excellent book on dinosaurs and the expanding Earth. And he points out that dinosaurs and also the dragonflies, this 300 million year mm-hmm. old dragon fossil that they found, they couldn't actually live in our environment today because of the gravity that we have today is not just a little stronger than it must have been back then, but a lot stronger, and that fact is very important to understand. It's not a small increase. We're talking about maybe as much as 400-500% increase in gravity on the surface of our planet. So that's a big, important clue as to what's going on.
Yes, and I mean, this is essentially borne out in the fossil record, isn't it? I mean, you know, and you talk about as Stephen Hurrell talks about, the large herbivorous dinosaurs like Brontosaurus and things like this, but it becomes even more of an extreme case when you look at the large insects and the flying dinosaurs, the Quetzalcoatlus and a few of those others. They, you know, because then you're into aerodynamics and power to weight ratios, so you can't really explain that away as easily as saying, well, these other dinosaurs like the Brontosaurus must have just waded around in swamps, you know, to keep their buoyant.
Yeah, yes. And the thing is that when you mentioned this for the swamps, I remember as a child I was fascinated by these kind of things. And there was an old book at my grandfather's summer house, and I loved it. It had the illustrations of dinosaurs swimming around in swamps, right?
Ah.
And obviously, this was a book that must have been printed in the 50s, I think. Mm. You know, so that's the idea of dinosaurs back in those days. But then they found the footprints of dinosaurs walking, right?
Yeah.
That, I don't know when they found that first, but that was after this book. So maybe in the 60s, 70s. And then suddenly, for no reason at all, suddenly, obviously, the problem with the weight that had made people convinced that dinosaurs must have waded around in swamps, they were suddenly just walking about. And nobody at that time asked the question, how?
Right.
It's amazing to me that you would conclude on something obvious in your mind, like, it had to be in a swamp. And then just a few years later, just say, no.
Yeah.
Without asking, you know, yourself, you know, well, how the heck did this happen?
Why they changed their mind, yeah.
Yeah, just changed their mind without even, I mean, wasn't there any discussion? I'm still a little baffled to the fact that people can just change their mind like that without asking sort of basic questions about could this even be done? Could it even happen? And it can't, because, I mean, this work by Stephen Earle is very thorough, and it's obvious that they couldn't actually walk around in today's gravity.
Yes, indeed, and it's actually, you know, if you read that calculation that he's done, it's relatively simple, isn't it?
Yes, very simple.
Yeah,
stuff.
I mean, it's basically surface area and volume, you know, comparisons, isn't it, that you have to consider.
Yes.
And mechanical
yes.
Force and pressure.
Yes.
So it's actually, you know, I was impressed that he'd actually just made it so simple, really, and that makes the argument for the force of gravity being the same back then very, very weak, because these creatures would have simply not been able to survive under their own weight. They would have crushed themselves to death, essentially, or parts of their bodies would have, you know, been crushed so that they couldn't function.
And they come up with all sorts of weird things just to try to get around this, you know, these long necks, these dinosaurs with a very long neck, right?
Right.
Getting blood up to the heads is a problem if you try calculating that. And so they have these tall dinosaurs hunched sort of to avoid the problem, and they have little hearts all the way up the neck, and they have all sorts of silly theories. It's just obvious to me that they're not daring to ask the simple question about gravity itself. I mean, that if you just say, well, obviously the gravity couldn't have been as high, then it solves all the problems. So why don't people take that seriously? And there's a reason for that, of course, because it's Newton. And you don't mess around with Newton.
This is it. I think, you know, that's become a kind of a dogmatic view, hasn't it? Because it's been around for 300 years, or, you know, 300 odd years. So that people just can't really, they're beyond questioning it, you know. So,
yes.
Yeah.
It's dogma. It's just one of these things that is considered as true as visual evidence. And it isn't. It's just something that Newton came up with, which made a lot of sense and still does in certain respects.
Mm.
But it's obviously not entirely correct. There's an error there.
So we're going to talk a little bit more about that in a few minutes, but I'd just like to, you know, try and take any listeners through the sort of thread that you've taken us through with these six articles that I've ended up posting, and I'll just read out the titles because I think that will then give a flavour of the sort of thinking that you've gone through, and then we want to talk about some of the you know, things that are factored into it. So the first one was Electric Universe, the Electric Universe Model of Gravity and the Expanding Earth. Second one was Universal Gravity Based on the Electric Universe Model, Expanding Planets and the Electric Universe Model, Dipole Model of Gravity and the Expanding Earth. Then we've got the Universal Gravity Based on a Dipole Model. And then my favourite one was the last one, which was, you just called, the Gravity Mystery. So I think there's obviously one phrase in there that we've mentioned cut three times, which is the Electric Universe Model. So perhaps we can talk a little bit about that, and then, you know, just if you want to go back and pick any of the articles that I've mentioned, or just, you know, any of the themes that are in them, and we'll talk about those.
Yeah, I can go through this list and say how this is basically my thinking.
Yes.
Which I've been very fortunate to be able to publish at your site, so that although it's work in progress, it's a step in the right direction, each of these, I believe. The first one, the Electric Universe model of gravity and expanding Earth. When I was working with Peter Woodhead on this problem, it was clear pretty early to me that the essential problem with the standard model that is the fact that they assume gravity to be a monopole. That means that it has only one feature to it. It only attracts. There's no plus or minus, north or south. It's just one thing that attracts another.
Yes.
It attracts things equally in all directions. And what I explore in this first article is the idea that gravity is not the monopole. And if it isn't, if it's a dipole, as suggested by by people in the Electric Universe community, then you don't get this problem that pressures inside the planet is very, very high, and we don't get the same results when it comes to an expanding Earth. So that's basically my work in there. I've worked then only in the first article there. I only talk about Earth.
Yep.
And I'm going a little up into away from the Earth to try to explain how things work on a distance. But I'm not talking about how the Earth is attracted to the Sun or the Moon is attracted to Earth.
Okay.
That I try to explain in the next article, where I try to develop a more universal theory of gravity based on this dipole.
And I think this is the article where you sort of introduce this idea of the repulsive force. Am I correct?
Yes, I'm looking there I'm looking into this idea that gravity has a repulsive feature to it, because the repulsive feature is the confusing part, because the moon, right? We have the moon hanging there outside, and it's attracted to us by gravity, we think. And if you have the dipole gravity, where you have the surface that's charged, right, gravitationally charged surface on the Earth, and the same charged surface on the Moon, from playing around with magnets, you know what happens, right? If you have two north poles facing each other, they just repel each other. So it's one of these problems that I tried to solve, and I solved it by suggesting that there's actually an inside and an outside part of our crust, right?
Right.
If we have a hollow planet, there's an inside and outside. And the outside might repel the outside of the moon, but the inside will actually attract the outside of the moon, and vice versa. And if you play around with these four combinations of surfaces attracting and repelling each other, then you end up with a model where you have gravity repelling at very short distances and at very large distances, but attracting in the intermediate distance. And the second theory, I present that idea. Now, about half a year later, I made revisions to both of these.
Yep.
So C and B in the list, or D in the list, are actually revised versions of the first two.
Okay.
Yeah. Where I've been thinking a little more, I'm not too happy with some of the details, and I hammer out some more. So, but they're essentially the same, so you can... It's more like there's a development there in my thinking. And so A and C, those are actually two versions of the same thing, and yes. So are B and D.
Great. Well, that's good to get that clarified as well, because I think I more or less understood that, you know, because I'd been through it as well. But I think it was very valuable that you've done it that way, because, you know, you can follow a path of thinking and hopefully, you know, see where, you know, which point you've got to. Because as you say, this is a work in progress. And I very much felt when I was talking to Peter that the gravity thing was really tough, because, you know, we haven't mentioned in our discussion tonight, and but you do mention it in the articles, the shell theorem. And this is what's thrown out at you, isn't it, when you try and say, well, what if, you know, if we've got this hollow centre to the Earth, or gas-filled centre, as Peter and I said, how does that affect the overall gravity? And then people will just say, well, even if it was true, which it isn't, it doesn't affect gravity because of this shell theorem. But what I liked was that you were giving basically a way of thinking about gravity, which was addressing what people had said about the shell theorem, in that, you know, the standard Newtonian model is that if you've got a big ball of metal hanging in space, and it's, you know, 100,000 kilometers from another big ball of metal hanging in space, those two masses are said to attract each other. But if you change, so what happens inside the sphere when you have an uneven arrangement of mass and it's not a uniform mass? Where does the gravity change? And the Newtonian, you know, shell theorem and all of that stuff doesn't answer that. It doesn't tell you anything about the distribution of mass. It just considers it all as being focused at the centre. But so what do you do when you've got an irregularly shaped mass, you know, and all of that? It doesn't. And your work, I think, goes some way to trying to address that issue, which is why I think it fitted in with what Peter and I had discussed, and why, you know, I wanted to put it on my website.
The shell theorem is it's the heart and soul of the standard model of gravity. So it's a piece of mathematics that that Newton did, and you have to remember that Newton was primarily a mathematician. He was really a genius in the true sense of the word, but it was his maths that was the really his very strongest. And then he's famous for his physics, of course, and he used the maths in his theory of gravity. And the shell theorem, in order to use the shell theorem, gravity has to be a point source. It has to be a monopole. Now, what I'm saying is that gravity is not a monopole. And if it isn't a monopole, you can't use the shell theorem. So all these attacks that you and Peter Woodard were getting with this just shell theorem being thrown at you, they can now be dismissed, because if you say, well, gravity is a dipole phenomenon, meaning that it has more in common with magnetism or a force like that has two, you know, a repelling and an attracting effect, then you can't use the shell theorem. The shell theorem, in fact, is you use it. You can actually use it to prove your point. You can prove that the center of a body like a large round body like Earth would not have any gravity at all. There wouldn't be any net gravity there. You would be, if it's hollow and you're in the center of this hollow sphere, you're floating around without any pressure from anywhere.
Right.
But if you have a point source or a monopole, as many call it, then the shell theorem is true, and then you have pressures at the center that are enormous. Right?
Right.
So this ties up to, this is a very important point. And it's essentially what what proves really. It's actually the way you can look at it is that the shell theorem is a piece of mathematics that's inherently true, right?
Right.
You can't actually say anything about maths. It's true, right? But you have to look at the assumption used in the piece of maths, mm. right? So what is this piece of maths talking about? This piece of maths is talking about a monopole, right?
Yes.
So it only applies to monopoles. Now, I came across a theory that is pushed by the electric universe community, and there the gravity is not a monopole but a dipole.
Yep.
Now, if you use a dipole and you use the same maths, you can still use the shell theorem, but then you can actually use the shell theorem to prove that it's not very high pressure in the middle of a planet. And also, you can prove that it's not true, necessarily, that if it expands, that gravity will fall. Because that's the shell theorem, concept of shell theorem too, is that if you have a body, a round body, that expands due to gas pressure, surface gravity will fall. That's a shell theorem thing, right?
Yep.
But since we now can dismiss the shell theorem, assuming that gravity is not a monopole, then we're home free as far as the pressure problem and the surface gravity problem is concerned.
That's great. And I mean, I think you've laid that out very well in these articles. If people want to read them, and you have included, you know, some of your maths.
Yes.
Which I know underwent several revisions, because, you know, some, and I could see that you were developing this and still actively working on it for, it was several months, wasn't it, that you were working on some of these articles all together, and they underwent several revisions. And we've already said that what's on there, there are basically four articles and two, you know, there are two articles with two versions each sort of thing. So people can work through that and follow your thinking, I think, fairly well and see where you've got to. And as I've already said, you know, I was very pleased to get hold of this, because it was, you were adding to you know, I couldn't really have got through this to the way that you've done it, because I don't know, I wasn't thinking of it like that. And I don't feel that comfortable with the mathematics as you do. I'm okay with it, but, you know, I think you were able to put it into the articles much better than I ever would have been able to. So that was also very useful. And I think, you mentioned the electric universe there, and I suppose I should ask you, when did you first become aware of the electric universe? Was that before you started looking at Earth expansion, or was it part and parcel of that?
It was actually when I was looking for alternative gravity models,
mm-hmm.
because... like I said, after talking to Peter Woodhead
mm-hmm.
about the problems and the fact that this shell theorem was used to discredit his work, I was interested in finding alternative gravity models, because I realized that the shell theorem that's rock solid. You can't really say anything about that. And also, as long as you use the standard model, they're dead right. It's correct what they're saying. The criticism is correct as far as if you just assume the standard model is true, then okay, it's also true that an expanding planet would have a surface gravity that actually fell. However, I was getting the feeling that it must be the gravity part of Newton's work that is the dodgy part, not the shell theorem. The shell theorem, I'm not going to mess around with maths. You can prove these things, right?
Right.
It's something that you can do on your own at home. But you can't actually prove gravity. That's much more dodgy.
Just to add to that, somebody mentioned to me, another physicist, the Gauss's theorem. He brought that into the picture. And Gauss's theorem is essentially the shell theorem, but with electrostatics, isn't it, or electrical charges, I think, if I understand that correctly. So
yes, I've looked into that a bit too, yes.
So,
but I don't see it as very different from Newton's.
No, it isn't. And I think it's essentially, it's just a form of calculus, isn't it, or an arrangement of calculus to sort of calculate the charge over an area and this sort of over a surface area and a volume, and it's the same with the shelf theorem. But anyway, carry on. I've interrupted you.
No, but that's quite clear. But the point that has to be kept in mind is that this is maths.
Yes.
People confuse often maths with physics, right?
Yes.
But maths is a tool that you can use once you figured out the physics. Like I said, smart people prove these things at home, you know.
Yeah.
It's not something that you can argue against. The physics, though, that's an entirely different matter, and that's why I was looking for an alternative model. I became aware of Electric Universe, and I looked into that and thought that was very interesting. So I stumbled upon more or less this alternative theory on gravity as being a dipole phenomenon. And then I realized, but that's the shelf theorem thing, right? If it's a dipole, then the shelf theorem goes. And then I realized that solves it. I stand by 100% even today. That's a very good, analysis. So it's very basically tells you that if it's a dipole, then the shelf theorem can be used, and then as a consequence, gravity at the surface of an expanding body does not fall, and the pressures inside an expanding body are not excessive. They're large, but they're not larger than what the steam produces itself. It's not the steam plus the weight of the crust, right? It's just the steam. That's the weight inside there. So if we were to go inside our planet today and measure the pressure there, you would solely be measuring the pressure of the gas. There's no addition pressure of the surrounding mass, right? So if you're inside this granite ball, right? But the granite isn't adding to the pressure, it's only the gas itself. And that's very important to keep in mind, because if that wasn't the case, then you wouldn't be able to produce an expanding Earth with a gas expansion. The standard model, if you use that, then you realize quickly that no temperature is so high that you will actually be able to produce gas. But in a dipole model, actually the default is gas at the center. That's, I would think, every single body, even the moon, small bodies even, have a gas field.
We touched on that as well in the articles that Peter and I did, or the two articles, like we mentioned that idea that the moon also had gas at the centre at one time, and if people were to read that article, you know, we concluded, I think, that perhaps most of the gas from inside the moon has gone, you know, and its expansion phase has finished. That was sort of what Peter had concluded, and I think I agreed with him really. And, but this whole thing, you know, reminds me of the other thing I was going to mention at this point. Because we basically said there, no, we don't agree with this idea anymore that we've got this solid core with ultra high pressures. And of course, I think there's a kind of a contradiction in the standard model in a fairly simple way, in that the standard model says that the Earth's magnetic field comes from a molten iron core. But
yeah, that's not true.
I don't think it's true. Partly because, you know, one of the things I was taught early on in my physics lessons was that if you heat, one way to destroy magnetism in a bar magnet is to heat it up to red hot.
Okay.
you know.
Exactly.
So
makes no sense.
Yeah, and then that brings me on to, so if we say, right, okay, so the Earth's magnetic field is not caused by by a molten iron core or anything like that. It brings me on to this Gerard Polak video that we both mentioned, because I watched that a couple of weeks ago, and I think you mentioned it in the email, and perhaps you'd like to say how that the magnetic field thing ties in with what he was putting on the table in last year's 2015 Electric Universe Conference.
Yeah, that's an excellent video. In fact, all the videos I've seen with Gerald Polak are just excellent videos, really worth watching.
Mm.
This one you mentioned, he points out that the atmosphere around our planet is actually charged.
Yep.
It's and this charge is moving because we have this jet stream, right? So what you have is essentially a moving current that moves at great speeds very high up in the atmosphere. Now, a moving current at great speeds would create a magnetic field. And it's that simple. So he postulates that magnetic field of our planet is actually the atmosphere moving around as a current. And producing this the same way you induce magnetism into electrical motors and things like that. That's how you do it. You don't have a iron core necessarily to do that. It's added for effect, but no, it's not really necessary. And besides, our planet's full of iron. It's not like there's no iron there, so that would probably help. We have a current moving around a body that's full of iron. you would generate a magnetic field. It's that simple. And there might be other things. I mean, there might be things on the inside of our planet too that moves around. We don't know. They might be slushing around there, moving around for different reasons. So all of these things add up.
You know, we may also have the situation if we talked about, Gerard Polak talks about gas in the atmosphere, essentially, movements of gas creating currents because of the charge on the gas particles. Perhaps there is something going on with the gas inside the Earth too. So like you say, perhaps there is gas movement inside the Earth, which is also creating charge separation and charge concentrations there too. It's probably a fairly complex scenario. Clearly it's much easier to observe the atmosphere than it is to observe 500 miles below the surface of the Earth or thereabouts, or 500 kilometers. But nevertheless, I think it's, and I mentioned it when I was talking to Peter, I can't remember if he mentioned it first or I mentioned it first, these things like telluric currents, which are well known. We have these currents in the surface of the Earth, and they're called telluric currents. And then we have, I think, you mentioned in your article, the aurora, and they're also a form of, they're openly stated to be a phenomenon caused by the interaction of charges with the Earth's magnetic field, and so forth. So that right there.
Aurora, the way I understand it, is actually a connection with the sun. So
yes,
there's an electrical connection between the sun and our planet, which goes through the aurora. And that's where I postulate them that our planet is fully charged, that it displays all the characteristics of a charged body, and the auroras looks like that might be where the current is coming in to the, and then you have lightning, which, by the way, happens mostly along the equator. There's very little lightning happening north of a certain latitude. I'm a Norwegian. Up in Norway, you just get lightnings at very special times of the year. It's not a very common phenomenon. If you go further south, you have it all the time. So it looks like we have a situation where current is coming from the sun goes in through the poles, charges the earth, as a makes it the charge body, and then you have discharge along the as lightning. And many of these lightnings actually go up. That's something that people aren't generally aware of, but there are lightnings going out into space. So that would be a discharge, for sure.
Right. And, you know, when you start to look at it in that way, I think it, you know, certainly when I read your most recent article and thinking about those things more clearly, I think it brought those things more sharply into focus, the things, the sort of things that you were saying, and other things too, which I can perhaps bring out one or two things from the other parts of your article. I recommend people read through this. It is about 12,000 words, so, you know, it's a bit of a read, it's definitely worth it. I read through it probably in, not very long, I think a couple of hours or something, if that. And so one of the things was the thickness of the atmosphere. I'm just picking out here because that was one of the things that also came up with earlier on in our discussion, that we were talking about these. Initially, we were talking about the dinosaurs roaming around in swamps. And, you know, that doesn't really seem to stack up when you look at all the problems with that, such as, as we've already said, the giant dragonflies and the other flying dinosaurs, which clearly couldn't have been roaming around in swamps. But there was this other theory with that, wasn't there? And I actually wrote to this gentleman, I forget his name, that he said that the atmosphere had to support the weight of the dinosaurs, so it must have been, if you want to carry on with that bit where he said that it was...
It's a great read. I encourage people to look him up. His name is David Esker, and he writes a very convincing essay, fairly short thing, not that many pages, yep. I believe, where he explains why dinosaurs and these giant dragonflies and things like that couldn't exist today. It's very, very convincing. And probably draws a lot from Stephen Hurrell, I suspect, since Stephen Hurrell has done excellent work on that too. So there he comes towards the conclusion. That's when he really makes this really puzzling claim. And he does this because, again, and this is very interesting. He states clearly that he doesn't want to change he doesn't want to attack the standard model of gravity. So since he refuses to suggest even that there might be something wrong with the standard theory, he comes to the logical conclusion that there's only one way these animals could actually have existed, and that is if the buoyancy of our atmosphere was much higher. Right? So you could imagine that it was almost like water. You could almost swim in this atmosphere. I shake my head and I think, oh boy, you know, it's sad, because it's a perfect thinking all the way, and then he comes down with this idea that the buoyancy of the atmosphere, on the face of it, the first thing you think of, oh, that's clever. I didn't think about that one. Yeah. So I think, that's cool. And so, yeah, so you can sort of imagine all these animals just floating about in the atmosphere. Sort of flying is no problem anymore because, well, you have this, it's almost like a fish, right?
Right.
So, and then, yeah, I think this is quite a stretch, but then, you know, just even basic understanding of physics, you know, that this does hold, because what you have is that, if you look it up, the buoyancy of our atmosphere today is 1 gram per liter?
Okay.
And you need 500 grams per liter to get the proper buoyancy, right?
Okay.
So you have 1 gram per liter, which is the buoyancy today, and then what you need to get the dinosaur walking around is 500 grams per liter. If you use Boyle's law, this is basic physics. Boyle's law is proven in a laboratory. It's not,
yes,
it's not even a discussion point, right?
Right.
You realize that the pressure of the atmosphere must be 500 times higher. Now, how are you going to create an atmosphere 500 times the pressure? Imagine that. How deep do you have to go in the ocean to get to that kind of pressure?
Yes.
It's just, yes, mind-boggling, right? So obviously it makes no sense.
I mean, I had exactly the same reaction, I think, when I read this, and I thought, oh yeah, he's going to get it, he's going to go for it. And then he, as you say, he comes out with this sadly ridiculous conclusion. And I ended up writing to him. It was probably a couple of years ago I wrote to him.
Okay.
And just to see what the deal was, really. And he was actually quite abrupt and abrasive in his response.
Yeah.
So I just left it, you know. It was a bit, like you say, it was a bit sad, really, because as you said, it was very short, succinct, clear thinking. And then it's like he just puts a bucket on his head for the last bit, you know.
Yes, very much. That's so, the impression I got too when I came across this, independent from you, apparently. But
yes,
it's the sort of stuff you stumble upon when you research this subject. Lots of,
yes, it is, and you get into some quite murky areas as well. So.
Yes.
Yeah, so that I think is also worth people considering. And the other thing which I was greatly interested in, which you'd written about in the other articles as well, because this was tying in directly to what Peter and I were talking about, was what you'd written about mountains and subduction. And I liked how you'd kind of described how, you know, you're taking this idea of the dipole model and charge and so forth, and you then try to sort of cross-reference that with the gravity anomalies and the thickness of the crust. So I don't know if you could, you know, you could talk about that for a couple of minutes.
Yes. When I come back to, because I mentioned it initially as a sort of an indication that there's something,
yes,
very interesting going on when it comes,
yes,
to gravity and geologically active areas.
Right. That's, yes, what I mean. Yeah.
Yes. And then I come back to it after I come to the conclusion that it must be, gravity must be related to capacitance and the ability of our planet to store charge. The thing is that with a capacitor, which basically is any object that stores charge, is a capacitor, right? And so to start with that, just so people are clear on that, it's not a very magical thing. Everything is a capacitor, actually,
yes,
because everything can actually store some charge. So the fact is that Earth is a capacitor. That's also a thing that can't actually be discussed. You can't actually question whether the Earth is a capacitor. Earth is a capacitor.
Yes.
Because it can store charge. So obviously it is. Now the thing is that if you have a capacitor, a hollow capacitor, it turns out that the hollow capacitor is much better at storing charge than a solid one. And we're proposing that Earth is hollow. So that actually increases the gravity or the capacitance, certainly, of our planet.
Yep.
And since I'm linking capacitance one-to-one with gravity, so if you have an increase in gravity, so what you then have is that a capacitor has this strange behavior that it actually becomes more efficient if it becomes thinner. It's one of these counterintuitive things where you think,
yes,
if it's going to store a lot of charge, you need a big thing. No, you actually want to make it as thin as possible without breaking it. So you can make it so thin that it actually blows up, right?
Yes.
But we still got some way to go, I hope, with our planet, with 470 kilometers depth is the calculation, I believe, that we came to. But anyway,
right.
Earth started out as fairly solid, maybe completely solid even, and had a low capacitance relative to today. And capacitance increases not linearly, but exponentially as it increases in size. That means that if our planet has increased in size to the double, which is what we believe from geological records, then gravity hasn't increased by doubling. It has increased by much more than that. And we're looking at 500% as a possible number. Well, that actually fits the capacitor model. The capacitance of a planet, if it's hollow and has expanded, is certainly about 500% higher today than it was at the start. And that's right. Why I make the connection with gravity and say, well, capacitance is the phenomenon that actually matches the observed gravity changes. So when we had a small planet, gravity was low. When it expanded, it increased, and it increased by a large amount, not by a little, right? And that's right. Kind of astonishing. And the only thing that actually behaves that way is capacitance that I know of. The capacitance actually behaves that. If you make a capacitor a little larger, it increases its capacitance quite a lot. Right? So if you make it larger and thinner, which is exactly what happens to an expanding planet.
Yes.
Its crust becomes larger and thinner. If it's larger and thinner crust, then you get stronger capacitance, better capacitance, and therefore, if it's one-to-one related to gravity, gravity will be similarly increased. Now, what you actually asked me about, now I'm getting to the point about mm-hmm. the mountains. Right?
Yes.
And the
right.
And rifts. Now, what we have on our planet is we have mountains and we have rifts. We have the examples like Himalayas, and we have Iceland as a Iceland is
yes.
a rift. Right? And we have Himalaya as a mountain. Now, the odd thing is that both of those areas have very high gravity compared to other places. So, what's going on? It seems like two very different places. What do these two places have in common? Not much, it seems, on the face of it. So why do we see this similarity? Now, the similarity is, of course, in general, that both are geologically active areas, right?
Yep.
Now, if you have a geologically active areas, there's two things going on. In an expanding Earth, certainly a hollow one, you will have the following happening. If you have a rift like Iceland, it's quite clear and easy to understand that, well, that area will be thinner. It's stretched, right? So you have an area that's being stretched, so it becomes thinner. Since it's a capacitor, the Earth is a capacitor, then the charge stored in the Iceland area is higher. So there's more gravity. There's stronger gravity. So that explains Iceland, and it's quite easy to understand that one. What's a little more tricky, but it's not that difficult to understand, is that if you understand how the Himalayas can come about, Himalayas do not come about by this subduction.
Right.
Because that's, I attacked the standard model, the standard plate tectonics model in my essay, right? I'm saying that isn't what's going on. What's going on is that you have a crack as the Earth expands. The old continents, right, they will have to fit onto a larger globe. Now, the only way you can get an old crust to fit onto a larger globe is to crack it here and there. Now, if you crack it, like with the typical places you would crack it are sort of places like, I think maybe for many, Italy is a good example, actually, because you know we have the Alps north of Italy. Well, if you move Italy up a bit to fit it onto a larger globe, then there would be a crack very quick, right? And that's Davos. And the same with it, with India. If you take all of India and push it onto this bigger surface, which is the Pacific, the Pacific has sort of blown up on the side of India, right? So now you have this larger surface, you have to crack India up a bit. Now when you do that, you get protruding mountains, right? This is part of what happens when you crack something up. It's hard to explain. Illustrations would help on this one. But you will actually get things going up. But you don't get a route going down. There's no route going down under the Himalayas. What you have is a crack. There's a big crack going up into the Himalayas. So when you're standing on top of the Himalayas, you're standing on a very thin crust, actually. There's very little under there. There's a crack. There's all the gas under there. And so you have a very thin, again, you have this thin crust. It's thin.
Yes.
And if it's thin, then capacitance is high.
Yeah.
And if it's high capacitance, and capacitance and gravity is related, one to one, well, you have higher gravity. And it sort of explains that here. So the whole capacitor model explains also why these areas that look like they're very different, like Iceland and Himalaya, are in fact both having this high gravity. The high gravity is due to the fact that there are, these are thin crust areas. So even though these mountains are high, the crust is actually very thin at these places.
And that's it. And I think you've drawn that out in one of the earlier articles as well to sort of make that a little bit clearer for people. And, I think that
yes,
coupled with your description, I think should enable people to grasp, I think, what you're saying there. And I was, again, that was one of the things that I was intrigued that does, again, explain another of these anomalies with gravity, which, you know, so many other people seem to be having difficulty, you know, explaining. And I think just to add to that,
yes,
sort of area a little bit, but, you know, in the interview, I think the second interview that Peter and I did, we sort of went through some of those types of things. We didn't go into the capacitance thing, I don't think, but we sort of came to the conclusion that the mass of the Earth might have been overestimated because of the gravity-related calculations and so forth. And Peter had sort of roughly come out with this idea that the mass of the Earth was perhaps only 11%, you know, if we're going with this gas-filled core, was only 11% of of what the stated mass actually is. And if you take that to a sort of logical conclusion, then it means that there's no need for dark matter, because I think they were saying that 90% of the universe is dark matter or something, and there is no need for that anymore.
Yeah. What I'd like to say though is that in the model that I propose, where gravity is a function of capacitance, the whole idea of measuring the mass of objects based on gravity falls apart.
Yes.
Right? It doesn't really make any sense. You could have something that's produced, made of very light material that could still have a very high capacitance. Actually, this is a very interesting point too, because I don't mention this in my essay, but it is, I think I mentioned it earlier in one of my earlier essays, The Expanding Planets and the Electric Universe Model. I make a quick calculation for various planets. And here's an interesting thing, is that Mars is used, it's a favorite example by, Neil Adams, you interviewed Neil Adams,
yes,
didn't you? And he, in his interview, she kept saying, and I see when corresponding with this man, that he keeps mentioning Mars as an example of how things must have been on Earth early on.
Okay.
Right? The atmosphere is clearly different, but it's roughly the same size. Now, the very interesting thing there is that Mars has a radius that's about half of our planet, but its gravity is less. Gravity is only 30-something percent. That means that if Mars were to grow and add mass to it, according to the standard model and according to this added mass theory that certain people favor, then even if it was to grow to the size of our planet, and then added mass would be iron and rock, which is the same material that it's already created, but by red, then you end up with you don't get enough gravity. You don't get enough gravity adding matter.
Right.
So you have to add super dense matter to get this number. And this is one of the stupid things that you come across when you read about Earth. Earth has a super dense core, according to certain people adhering to the standard model.
Yes.
And why do people believe that there's a super dense core of in Earth? The reason is that they're comparing Earth to Mars, and they're realizing that, well, either Mars is composed of something extremely light, right?
Okay.
But Mars is a red planet. It's iron. That's a very heavy material. So you have a very heavy looking object out there, and it's too light. It doesn't make sense. So then, well, they come back to Earth and say, well, okay, so Mars looks like it's made of something heavy. We must be made of something even heavier. And this is the sort of nonsense you get into if you think that it's mass on mass interaction, right?
Yes.
You think you can weigh and also looking at gravity, but then you end up with a super dense core, and well, that's nonsense again, because nobody has ever created any super dense matter. I mean, what is super dense matter even? What is it? I can imagine a gas being very dense, right? You can pressure a gas and it can compress it, right? But can you compress matter, sort of solid stuff? You can't. How do you compress a rock into something half the size of the original rock? You can't, right? There's no pressure that you can apply that would actually produce a super dense core. It doesn't make any sense. There's another one of these things that don't make any sense, that we solve them as soon as we say, well, it's not actually mass on mass interaction. It's charge in the capacitor acting on mass. That's what gravity is.
That's right, and a lot of these problems, I think this is one of the things that comes out if you watch some of the Electric Universe videos and so forth and study their work. You get that similar simplification of certain things, which they've had to introduce all these fudge factors and guesswork to try and explain, you know, various obvious things. And like you say, you give them some good examples there of what becomes much more simplified if you just consider this dipole model of gravity or something, you know, very similar to that. But I'd like to just also ask you a couple of things. The work of Emmanuel Velikovsky, which was the Worlds in Collision book, I wondered if you'd actually ever read that and, what your thoughts might be on that.
No, I haven't read that book. I know it's one of these books that people in this Electric Universe group are raving about, and But I just, what I know is basically what they've been saying in their videos. So I'm no expert on what... It sounds a little fantastic. There's a little bit too much, explosions and collisions and things going on.
Yeah, so, the Velikovsky thing, again, like you, I'd heard about the book and I've listened to a few interviews of people about it, but I managed to get hold of an electronic copy and I spun it through on my ebook reader. And it is quite interesting, and I think it's just worth... really, all I wanted to mention was, rather than going into any kind of long discussion, it's what it made me realise is that this electric universe thinking, is its roots are definitely, I think, in the Velikovsky book, from my way of thinking. So anybody that's listening to this that wants to see where many of these ideas seem to have come from or were first kind of put out into the public... mindset, as it were, the domain was in the Worlds in Collision book. So it's worth having a look at that. And there is some good stuff in there. There's some other stuff which I think is a bit, it's perhaps less convincing. But there's certainly some good thoughts in there about. He does mention about the formation of mountains and things like that, which is quite interesting. And then I think, I'll try and sort of round it up for this hour. We can always come back to this and do some more. But I wondered how much you'd thought about other aspects of gravity, not so much in the cosmological sense or the sense of the Earth. You know, I don't know how much of the other stuff that you've looked at on my website. I know we've talked, just corresponded very briefly about it. But, I think that there is a certain group of people that already know a lot more about gravity, and some of the stuff that I was looking at was about how anti-gravity research was being done back in the 50s, and it all seemed to go underground in about 1955. I don't know if you'd ever looked into that side of things at all, in any of things that you'd come across.
I have looked into it, and I find it very interesting. What I find, although I'm not really able to come to any sort of intelligent conclusion on what's going on, but certainly if gravity is a dipole, like I'm suggesting, and I've been suggesting since the very first of my articles, then the possibility of anti-gravity is obviously there. That must be some, at least in theory, possible with levitation and that sort of thing. I've been thinking, though, that if you want to create levitation, certainly around, close to our planet, there might be other things that might be easier to use. Like there's this electric gradient, that play around with that, or the magnetic field, or things like that might give you the same sort of effects, right? A very sort of this levitation, if that's what you're after. There might be other things than just gravity that can give you that. In my essay, my final essay, I'm deliberately a little vague as to how gravity actually works on a celestial level, right? Orbits and like that. And the reason is that I can't actually make up my mind, I haven't actually made up my mind at the moment, whether gravity has an anti-gravity effect on the moon and there's something else pulling it into its orbit, or whether, there's several possibilities, and I've outlined one of them in one of my earlier essays. But that doesn't mean that I haven't completely decided on any one of these theories. So how exactly things work beyond, we know, of course, that gravity pulls us down and small bodies down, but how it actually interacts between larger bodies, and whether or not it's possible to simulate a large body to produce anti-gravity effects by charging a capacitor and things like that. People have been playing around with this it's not like I'm the first to think about capacitors as a possible anti-gravity device or gravity device even.
Right. I mean, and you know, this does indeed, I think, tie in at some level with these. You know, you might want to look at the lifter devices that you can build, which, you know, I did this about eight or nine years ago, where you can actually create what appears to be an anti-gravity effect with, you know, an HT unit of an old CRT monitor about, you know, sort of 20 kilovolts. And you can build an asymmetric capacitor, as it's called, and you can get this thing to lift off. And this ties into the work of Thomas Townsend Brown that he was doing in the 1930s and 40s and there onwards.
Yes.
You know, and also, you know, one of my, how I got into all this sort of alternative knowledge research was actually studying the UFO issue. And, you know, without going into that into any great detail here, you know, I'm sure you yourself will have heard these stories that these craft often seem to be associated with electrical charge phenomena. You know, when people who encounter these things get near them, you know, they'll feel experiences, you know, have experiences where they'll experience charge, you know, electrical charge, radios get affected, and car engines are said to go dead and so forth in some of the more historical accounts. So I do think that you know, basically somebody knows a lot more than we do, and they're much further down the road than we are with a lot of this thinking, to the point, you know, and I have no doubt that it's to the point where they've engineered it into technology, basically. You know, so that's, I've written a lot about that on my website in various forms, so other people can go and check that out if they wish. But I think for now, Frederick, you know, I think we've covered a reasonable amount of ground, and I think what you've laid out is very lucid, and I think also particularly the last article, and also the other articles as well that we've described, which are all on checktheevidence.com, you know, I think if people go and read those, it'll give them a lot to think about. And, you know, if they've got anything to add, they can email me and I can forward it to you, or, you know, I'd be happy to hear from people. But, you know, have you got anything else that you'd like to sort of add before we sort of just finish for now?
Not really. I think it's gone really well. I'm very open to any suggestions. And I state that in my latest essay. I think what this reverence that so many people have towards the established thought is it's misplaced, really. And if you have a good consistent good ideas that actually make sense, and I'd love to hear about them.
Yes, me too. Well, okay then, Frederick. Well, I think for now then, I'd like to greatly thank you for spending time with me tonight just to record this, and also, I mean, that I think gives something very valuable to add to the very valuable work that you've done on this, which I, as I said earlier on, I was very happy to post on Check the Evidence. And I hope that you will continue to look into this, you know, as you feel is appropriate, and the work in progress continues. And I think also, I think one of the things we did would be nice is if there is some kind of acknowledgement from the Electric Universe community for some of these ideas.
Very nice to see. I actually have some contact in there, but every now and again I get some feedback. So it's nice whenever that happens. We'll see. I'm certainly going to continue thinking about these things. I enjoy it a lot, and I'm really thankful to you for posting these things, even if they're sort of in progress, like they are all along, really. But I think this panel, if your listeners want to read my work, then they should definitely start with the gravity mystery, And most of my thoughts are summarized there, and then they can look into the other ones if they want to have more details.
Great, and I think I'll just close by saying that I do know that Stephen Hurrell had posted the link to the article on his Facebook thread.
Yeah.
I don't know if you knew that, because I'd posted it on mine and he picked it up, I think, and put it on his. So that was also a nice little acknowledgement. Oh, so.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, if people can link to it and talk about it and bring it up with other people who they know find this kind of stuff interesting, I'd love to hear from people.
Great.
Yeah.
Okay then, Frederick. Well, again, I think I'll thank you for tonight, and we may do another follow-up hour at some point, see how this goes and see if there's any other thoughts that you want to add. But I think for today and for now, again, thank you very much for spending time with me, and I'll edit this down. We've got a few Skype dropouts, I think, but hopefully people should get this clearly enough. And I'll again say thank you very much.
Yeah. Thank you.